to introduce myself. My name is Zalinda Smith. I am 46 years old. I'm an African-American woman living in Metro Detroit. I actually live in the suburbs of Detroit, Michigan, in a city called Canton.
And I am Jeffrey Glazer. I am 60 years old, and I am a white American living in Los Angeles, California. So just to begin, why don't you tell me how you came to Reparation Generation?
I was introduced initially to the idea from a founding member, David Mayer. I actually worked for David at his company, Mayer Laboratories. And we always have these extensive conversations about just life and everything that's going on. So after the COVID pandemic first began in the beginning of the year, there started being a lot of racial tension, as we all know, in the country. I think it's always been there, but it really, really got escalated with the death of George Floyd. It brought out so many emotions in so many people. We were having discussions about that, and I would tell him my frustrations sometimes. And it was really nice to be able to have those conversations. And then he introduced me. He says, I have an idea. I have something I've been working on, I've been thinking about, and I want to share it with you. And if you're interested, let me know. If it's something you're not interested in, just let me know. So he initially sent over, we called it a manifesto, but it wasn't necessarily that, but just kind of what he was thinking, like a plan. And to be honest with you, when I first read it, I cried. I did. It brought so many emotions out in me, more than I could ever think of coming from one person. That's when he introduced the idea of Reparation Generation, and I was all in. He asked me, did I know anyone that I thought would be interested? And I absolutely knew people that I thought would be more than happy to be a part of the organization. What about you?
Actually, not that different. So I also have known David for a very long time. I knew him for my freshman year at college. We went to Berkeley together. And similarly, he called me and said, I've been thinking a lot about what's been going on. And I don't know if exactly he was at the stage where he had already sort of started the organization, but he said, you know, I wrote something and I'd love you to read it and talk to you a little bit about sort of this thing I'm thinking about doing. And so he sent me the same document I think you saw, which I actually, funny, I sort of refer to as a manifesto too, but you know, I read it and I thought it was very heartfelt. It was impactful. And also it was a little like, I want to use the word scary, like, huh, like, David is like digging deep here, and it's not an easy thing to read. And so I read it, you know, one week, and I called him whenever I called him, and I just said, you know, this is really interesting, and I've got some thoughts, and, you know, kind of tell me what you're thinking about. Because I don't think I completely at that point knew what kind of the organization that he was talking about, that was happening yet. And he told me a little bit about it, and he said, would you be interested? And I said, yeah, I would be interested. I'd like to talk to you more about it, but in what way? And so that's kind of what began the conversation, and at the point in which I said, yeah, I'd like to be involved. And then he said, well, then, you know, we're going to have this meeting. And so it was a kind of a similar situation. So let me ask you, why is reconciliation important to you?
It's what's needed. It's what we need to do. We need reconciliation to move forward in this country. And I don't want to place blame on there's no one person to place blame on. But I feel like the last 4 years or so in this country, there's been so much division. Tensions are so heightened. We need to move past that, you know, as a country. When we look at our kids, I have a 4-year-old grandson. He doesn't know anything about race or ethnicity. All he knows is love, because that's how we raise him, on love. So he loves everyone. And I have a ton of things I could be angry about or, you know, hold grudges about. But I choose love and I choose peace, because I want us to be able to move forward. And that's what we need to do as a country. And the reconciliation comes from the acknowledgement and, you know, taking action to show how sincere we are about moving forward. And it's what we need overall to move forward. What do you think?
You know, I thought a lot about this, because, you know, both when David brought this up and even hearing the word reparations and having listened to Ta-Nehisi Coates' article, the long article he wrote about reparations, it felt like it was more about kind of, again, the physical or the readdressing wealth and money and so forth. But the reconciliation part, I've come to realize it's really about the need for people, and in this particular case, I believe especially white people, that you can't change things fundamentally until you really acknowledge the history and acknowledge the truth of what's going on now and what's happened in the past. And that to fail to do that means that, you know, you can give all the money in the world to an organization and say, you know, I'm trying to do my part, I want to do better, and here's a bunch of money that hopefully will help. But that's really only a piece of it, because I think, and especially when you talk about kids, for instance, I think until you can be honest with yourself and with other people to say, this is how I've participated in a system that has held people back or that has discriminated or that has, you know, really harmed people. Until you can acknowledge that and see either your part in the perpetuation of that or your part in the way you've benefited, then things won't ultimately change. Again, I think, you know, the biggest billionaires in the world could give money, but if people don't fundamentally acknowledge that this is a truth, that people experienced this history, and I have to really open my eyes to it and see what happened and how that system has been perpetuated and the way in which I've lived in that system, I don't think you'll ultimately get true change. So that's why I think that, you know, the reconciliation part is truly as important as the reparation aspect.
I agree 100%. That leads me to why reparations are important to me. I think that it's a more than one step process. Like you just said, the reconciliation is so important because it's bigger than the financial portion of it. People sometimes do feel like the money portion can solve all the wrongs that have been done. Don't get me wrong, there is a financial aspect to this that needs to be settled, and that needs to be settled immediately. I think that we've suffered enough in this country. We've struggled enough, and I've watched people, you know, become very successful while African Americans are often left with nothing, less than nothing. So the reconciliation is the emotional portion, and the reparations is the financial portion. And they go hand in hand. It's a two-step process, or even more, for that matter. But the reparations are important because the financial capital needs to be spread equally in this country. It's time out for people to continue to spread their wealth amongst themselves, and it's ill-gotten money. It's ill-gotten goods. Mm-hmm. It's important to try, because you can't necessarily repair hundreds of years of damage with money. But it's time to try to at least make an effort to spread that wealth so that we can put money into our communities. Our children deserve fair education, equal education. We deserve opportunities at housing and land equity. We deserve the opportunity to own businesses equally without prejudice in that process. And that's what we are dealing with. You've got people that have ill-gotten money and this wealth that they've spread on for generations and generations that was stolen, to be honest. It was stolen. I literally have family members, and I think so many African Americans in this country. If you put us in a room, almost everyone in that room can tell you a story of land or money that was stolen from our families generations ago and that have left us to have to start over or left us with nothing. Even family members have died, you know, in that process. So many. And so it's very important that we begin to have a fair shot at the wealth in this country, because this is how the country was made. It's how it was developed. It's how we got to where we are. And we deserve a shot.
You know, and I also, I find it's interesting, the word reparation itself kind of has repair in its roots, mm-hmm. even though we are talking about financial, monetary, physical distribution, redistribution, however you want to call it. In some ways, reconciliation, you sort of is within reparations, like you kind of can't do one without the other. So it really is about, you know, systemic change, meaning kind of going down to the foundation and being able to say, you can do only so much, but you really have to get down to sort of the basics of, like you said, the lack of equity, the things that stand in the way are what reparations have to be about. And that is everything from literally like giving back, whether it's land and the 40 acres and a mule. I knew the term and I knew the idea, but I didn't realize that that had been essentially taken back after it was given, like shortly after it was given. That's something I learned during this process of interacting with people as part of Reparation Generation. And so the idea of land and what that means and how that builds wealth for people. And so it's land, it's redistribution of wages, lost wages that you know, wages that were taken away, that were stolen from Black Americans, Black people, you know, very early on. You have to really deal with it foundationally. And it's not about just handing a check to somebody and saying, oh, you know, here's something, sorry, and maybe this will be better. It's really looking at what was the land, you know, that was taken, what would that be worth in today's dollars? I mean, to me, that's, you have to look at it in those sort of stark terms and say, these opportunities were completely removed from people's existence, from people's experience to repair and to have reparations. We have to look deep down fundamentally. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly what form that takes, but it can't be done just by saying, you know, a combination of sorry and we'll try to do better.
Exactly.
So this is a question that's kind of a bigger question, but in what ways do you hope that reconciliation, reparation may lead to a renewed America or a more perfect union?
Well, like I said before, that's the only way for us to move forward, which leads to a more perfect union. The idea of a more perfect union sounds insane to me, because when you are Black in America, you do not feel like an American. So the concept of a more perfect union, to me, it sounds insane. Is it something that I want to see? Absolutely. I would love to see that more than anything else, but it sounds like another planet. But without reconciliation, without reparations, without seeing a sincere effort from some people, and we're not asking for our feet to be kissed, you know, but it was the simple acknowledgement for me in reading David's manifesto that brought the tears to my eyes, because this is something that it's unheard of. You don't hear people even acknowledging it.
Right.
And so I think for a lot of African Americans, the acknowledgement in itself, to hear a sincere apology and the action behind it that says we are serious about what we're saying and we want to move forward and we are, you know, sincerely want to see equality across the board. Oh my gosh. If I can live to see that day, I can't even tell you how that would make me feel. It's beyond, it literally makes me feel like it would be another planet. What about you?
I think that in particular, the killing of George Floyd and obviously the protests that followed, and I think it was not just George Floyd, I think it was the fact that there had been so many incidents that led up to it that were individually terrible, but then there was this one that just hit that nerve on that such a deep level of the injustice. You know, it caused me, it caused obviously lots of people to think and to speak out. And I think what we experience and what white people, and if I can speak as a white person and my experience, but I think what a lot of white people experience is that they experience fear. You know, nobody wants to see protests. No one wants to see rioting. And that fear is a manifestation of the fact that we have such an imperfect union. And by, you know, really digging into this notion of being able to face our history and tell the truth and look at ways in which we've been complicit in discrimination and systemic racism, it has the potential, and reparations has the potential to get us to a place that we don't have to live in this world that every so often, because it has been every so often, there are uprisings, there are riots, there is a pushback, there is a reaction to incredible injustice. And that feeling that I, as a white person, has when I see this, which is this terrible feeling of injustice, but there is probably a little bit of like, how am I guilty? How am I, even if I'm complacent because I don't know what to do, there's a little bit of that. I think there's a sense of powerlessness. Like, we see this thing happen, but what can I do? And how can I do something that's going to change this? Because I'm just one person, and it is a reminder of such a imperfect America. And how do you go about renewing that? One of the things that I've been thinking about is that we all do such a disservice to each other, because it creates this barrier too. Like, it's very hard to have authentic relationships often with people of other races, because there is this unspoken, now maybe, but often unspoken truth about the past that either we don't want to confront, or it's very hard to confront it. We don't have the words, the forum to have the hard conversations for us to get beyond this. You know, I know that there are some people that have legitimate and authentic relationship with people of other races. But I think that, you know, I lived in Oakland for many years and I taught in Oakland in schools. And yet, even when I was in, like, really inside of a Black community, I didn't really feel part of it. That's the thing that we all miss. And what's a shame is that we can't find ways to really come together. I mean, that you talk about coming together in a way that we can be more than just civil with each other, but to be friends, to be honest, true friends, to come together in a way that we feel like we can share as true people that are equal and as equal Americans. That imbalance is much more harmful than it has been to the Black community. I also think that white people and other non-Black people also feel like it makes for tension and it makes for lack of understanding. It makes for a world that is so far from what I think we ideally hope for. And, you know, whether it was Dr. King in the 60s or Barack Obama more recently, you know, you get these moments where people remind you of what is possible and you feel good and you have those glimmers of hope. And then we somehow get off that track. And so I think that reconciliation and reparation is sort of the only way we're going to get to that true, perfect union, you know, where we can really sit down and say, finally, we don't have to have these barriers or this level of discomfort. The biggest hope is that by really going through a process like that, we truly can move in a direction that takes us to a place that feels very optimistic and almost, like you said, unreal. But to live in a world that we could truly join together as equal human beings, it's so aspirational. And it's part of what I remember when Barack Obama was elected and when he gave those speeches. It really was the glimmer of hope that I think that in my generation, I never had experienced because I was too young when Dr. King was giving his speeches. So that you know that the hope is there and the possibility is there, but it really takes a lot of work.
Wow. You said a mouthful there. A lot of things that I totally agree with. And this is a kind of off the topic here. But it is a little uncomfortable sometimes. But it's dealing with the truth is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
You know, we're living in a country, in a world where racism is a serious issue. Race is no, there's technically no such thing as race because we're all the same race, which is human. But the inequality and the prejudice and the race prejudice or ethnic prejudice is real. And it's very uncomfortable, like you said. But that's why we're here, because we want to break that barrier down. And sometimes we get into conversations that I have a friend that I didn't know I was offending her in these conversations. I call her my sister. And it's funny because she's Caucasian, and we say we're sisters, and people are like, what? But that's how close we are. But she told me recently, she said, sometimes when we first met, we would have conversations, and I was just being open. And she would say, I went home and I cried, but I realized you were telling the truth, because she didn't realize she was in her privilege. She just was living her life. And I didn't realize I was offending her by calling her out on her privilege. But we worked through that. We had a lot of open conversations, but we are best friends right now, like sisters. It may get uncomfortable, but it gets better, you know? It's like working out. No pain, no gain.
Yeah. What do you hope receiving the reparation funding? How do you hope the funding will be distributed? And why is receiving these reparations important to you?
Personally, I think that, as we all discuss, I think that I was speaking with Kiko about home ownership for African Americans is at an all-time low over 50 years in this country.
Wow.
That alone is just ridiculous. And I can tell you my own personal struggles in trying to buy a home, and for so many people that I know, family members, friends, so many people that I know, it really is a struggle. And there are so many things that factor into that. What makes it difficult for us to acquire, you know, basic housing? It's ridiculous. So starting there, but for me, number two on my list is providing for children. I think I recently read somewhere, or maybe I was on social media or listening to the radio or something, and someone said it's easier to train the younger generation than it is to repair the older generations. Mm-hmm. So I'd really like to see a lot put into our kids' education, because there's unequal education. And also, like, financial literacy is very important for children and young people, providing education across the board, whether it's attending a four-year college or, you know, we all have different paths that we want to take. Everyone does not want to attend a four-year college. And from what we see now with the rate of student loans, a lot of people are doing much better learning a trade than actually going and obtaining a four-year degree. They're making more money. So I'd like to see education handled on all levels and put into business development. There are a lot of people that have amazing business ideas and dreams and plans, but they don't have the funding. They don't have the money to start up. The first couple years of owning a business, you need money. They may have the greatest business idea and the greatest plan, but if you don't have the money to get it going, you know, it fails. And so I'd like to see a lot of business development as well. I hope to see that money dispersed in the communities, and then each one teach one, give back. So once I learn how to develop my business and run it, or anyone, then you bring someone else on and teach them and show them as well. Once kids get proper education and learn financial literacy, they'll pass that on to their children. Knowledge is power, so we can't doubt that putting into education won't be a huge asset.
I actually want to go back to one thing. The thing that I wanted to say, because this is something I've thought a lot about since starting this process of, you know, talking to David and being involved with Reparation Generation, is it really did cause me to think more thoroughly, more actively about where I have privilege, where I have had privilege, because, you know, I've lived a relatively good life. I feel like I haven't been a particularly racist person, or I haven't felt like I've actively, you know, done anything negative. But what this process has really done for me is it really has made me think, where did I benefit? Where did me, my parents benefit just by the fact that I'm a white person? And it took me a couple of steps. I had to kind of go back and go, okay, well, what are the things that are traditionally things, you know, barriers for Black people or discrimination against Black people that I have not experienced, and therefore how is that translated to my privilege? And it really became relatively easy once I started to think about that. Things like my parents were able to first rent and then buy houses, I think fairly simply. I mean, they had to come up with the money, but there weren't barriers to where they could live, for instance. And so we were able to find safe places in decent neighborhoods. And then, you know, the second thing is, especially when we moved to the city that we lived in for most of my growing up, it had really good schools. And I think, I'm guessing that whether it was actively the case by the time I moved to this one city when I was 10, or whether it was just historically, the fact that there had been redlining meant that they were able to buy a house in a city that had really good schools. And I am guessing that the lack of minorities, diverse populations in that city, either it was just historic that because Black people and other people were not allowed to move there for a long time, they just didn't choose to. It wasn't a place that either people felt comfortable moving, or, you know, if they didn't know anybody else that was Black, why would they move there? And it could have been as much the case as that there was still either formal or more likely informal redlining at the time. And so that was another way that I benefited, which of course then led me to, I got a good education, which probably gave me more access to getting into a good college. So every sort of step of the way, I benefited from that privilege. It's just being able to look at it from that really basic way. You know, the other thing was, you know, when I went, my wife and I went to buy our first house, we didn't have all the money for a down payment just based on my salary and her salary. And well, we probably might have been able to get the lower down payment loan, but then our rates would have been higher. So we were able to borrow or get gifts from our parents that allowed us to get that down payment, which has turned out to be the best investment of my life. I don't think I'll ever make an investment that will have the same return that that first house had. What came with that was the privilege of having the support, intergenerational wealth, for instance, you know, somebody who had the means to say, we can help you with the down payment. So you can put 20% down and you can have the rates. You don't have to pay for that mortgage insurance, which would have been another burden, realizing that non-white people and Black people in particular often do not have these privileges, do not have this access. And so I wanted to bring that up because it's something I had thought a lot about in these past months. And so that's why it's so important to look within and really examine and say, you know, oh, I think I'm a good person. I haven't been a racist person. I don't do awful things. And yet the benefits, the privilege that you benefited from, that privilege is something that you just have to look at so that you're aware that we don't live in a perfect union. We don't live in an equal place, that just because all quote unquote men are created equal according to the documents in which we live by in our country, the fact is that just hasn't been true.
Agreed, 100%. And that kind of goes back to the conversations that I had with my friend. She walked in her privilege and she didn't realize it. She didn't know. She had no idea. She was telling me about things I had never heard of in my life, like birthright money. Oh, my family started birthright money. You get it when you turn this age. And I said, what is that? I've never heard of that in my life. What do you mean? I'm about 7 or 8 years older than she is. And she bought her first home when she was 21.
Wow.
And I had never seen her closing went so smooth. I had never seen a process like that. She literally bought the house in like less than a week. I had never seen that in my life. And I couldn't believe it. And I told her, I said, this has got to have something to do with you being white. And she's like, no way, no. I'm like, it has to. I've never heard of these things you're talking about, you know? So exactly what you said. Parents are able to help their children and pass the wealth on for generations. And then when her parents die, I'm pretty sure they'll leave her a lot of money. My parents passed away, and not that they didn't try, but there was no huge, you know, payout or any, none of that. Mm-hmm. There was, we paid for the services, we paid for the for the burial, and that was about it. So it's every day, almost everything you do, I want you to understand that. Every day, everything you do, you have privilege that you don't even notice. That you don't even know you have.
I mean, yeah, it's like the things like driving down the street. I never, ever would think about a taillight being out and being paranoid about, you know, those little things. That's a, just an implicit privilege that most white people never.
They never understand that it's there because they've never had to think about it. So
right.
We look forward to a time where that doesn't happen anymore.
Yeah.